Hello and welcome to Phoenix Cinema Podcast. I'm Chris Austin, and usually the next voice you would hear would be Luke Parker saying, and I'm Luke Parker. That's my Luke impression. But unfortunately, Luke will not be joining me today, but fear not, he will be back next episode. In the meantime, I'm joined by a truly special guest today. He is a composer of films such as Limitless, Dread, and Last Breath, as well as plenty of film documentaries, TV shows, and video games like Cyberpunk 2077. He has won a BAFTA and been nominated for numerous other awards, including another BAFTA and an Emmy. Dear listeners, it is my pleasure to introduce to the podcast Paul Leonard Morgan.
Paul Leonard Morgan. There you go. You could have just skipped the whole...
that whole preamble. Unnecessary.
For that bio. No, it sounds great. Thanks.
You're very welcome. No, thank you. Thank you for joining me today. So where are you joining me from, may I ask?
So I'm in my studio in Los Angeles.
In LA. Okay, brilliant.
And this ironically is absolutely pissing it down with rain today, whereas my studio in Glasgow, the guys there were going like, oh, it's a really lovely day here today. I was like, well, that's so nice for you.
Usually it's the complete opposite, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll start off by asking, how did you are you from Glasgow?
I'm from Glasgow. I have my posh accent because I went down to posh school down south of England, and then went back up to Glasgow when I was 18 for the Royal Scottish Academy of Music, or the Conservatoire, as they call it now. And then, yeah, stayed there until I was about 40. I turned 50 last year. So stayed there until I was about 40, and then the last 10 years have been in LA.
Lovely. So how did film scoring start for you? Was it from going to that Scottish Academy? Did you have a love for it before you enrolled?
Has film scoring started for me yet? I'm not sure. How did it start? Do you know, I say this not self-deprecatingly. I'm not trained in film scoring. So you get these incredible people that come out of like UCLA or the colleges over here or colleges in the UK or anywhere. And their production skills are freaking amazing, right? And they're just like, it sounds phenomenal. But some of the time I'm sort of like, yeah, but it hasn't got a tune. It's kind of missing a tune. They're like, oh, you don't need a tune. I was like, well, I know, but it's sometimes nice to have a tune. Whereas my background going to the academy was I went to go and study film music. I didn't even know it was a thing. You know, I was just like, I always loved film scores. I love soundtracks, love watching film. I love composing music. I've written music since ever, you know, crappy little keyboard, 6 years old at a school concert. You know, parents going, oh, isn't he sweet? And then the teacher fucked off after a term. I was like, that's not ideal. He buggered off to Hollywood. So I was like, okay. So I then studied with Sir Jimmy McMillan, who's an incredible, you know, concert composer. And John Maxwell Geddes taught me orchestration. And I basically spent 2.5 years teaching myself there with these teachers about orchestra, you know, sitting in the library, listening to Bernstein, listening to all these things. And I had no idea about the film music side. And when I was there, I started working with some bands because the Scottish music scene was really buzzing in Glasgow. So I was just kind of working with these people doing string arrangements. They're like, oh, there's a classical dude. So I've done my clarinet concertos while I was at college. And they're like, okay, classical dude, you can do string arrangements. So it's like Isabel Campbell from Belle and Sebastian with Mark Lanigan. And then doing some stuff with Snow Patrol and some stuff with Mogwai and some stuff with, you know, it was just kind of helping out here and there because there was in the studio. And then Texas and Simple Minds. And there was a producer, Tony Dugan, who kept on saying like, hey, come do strings. And he's a genius, so good. And then when a director had heard one of the bands I was working with, he's like, oh, do you want to do my short film? I was like, sure. I always wanted to do film music, but I don't know what I'm doing because my teacher buggered off after a term. So I did that. And then bands like the fact that you work with films, and films like the fact that you work with bands. And it just kind of became a circle then of gradually sort of finding out how you do it, I guess.
So you learn as on the job, you learn project to project.
Completely. And you know what? I was doing, I quit bit of background. You know, I then did some TV stuff. I got a BAFTA nom and I got a BAFTA newcomer thing for first short film that I'd done, but then did Silent Witness and Spooks was a great one, and some TV stuff, and then started getting some films off that. But the point of all this is, it wasn't until I was in the States and I was on a thing, the Minions short films, you know, these kind of little yellow things. Why am I doing this with my fingers? And it was then I was suddenly just like, oh my God, I'm learning so much. This is how you do animation, because animation is completely different. It's like you've got to have these hit points and so on. And again, like, you either have that way of teaching yourself or you don't. So when I was at the academy, I kept on taking my keyboard in and I was teaching myself how to do sequences as pre-computers almost, you know. So I think you've got to have that mindset of being able to kind of teach yourself on the job, and you have a kind of an aptitude for writing melodies or for reacting well to visuals or whatever. But I mean, in the end, what is film music? It's just music that's chucked on a film. Not a specific thing. I think it used to be this whole, you know, if you're John Barry, where you had to do the orchestra, but then you were also the DJ gradually, and then you were also producing, and now you have huge teams of people. But in essence, it's just a bit of music lumped against film, and whether it, in, you know, in its basic form. And it's like, does it work or not? Does it create the emotion? Does it help you feel something?
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually, because and I find some of my favorite pieces of film music are the ones that not only work in conjunction with what you're seeing play out on the screen, but on its own as well.
Oh, but you see, you're opening up a can of worms, because there are two sort of I'm more with you. If I'm writing something, I want it to have longevity. And I'm not saying I do everything with tunes, because I do some really weird shit as well. Like, people still refer to a soundtrack that I did called Dread. And they say, oh, I write all the time to your Dread soundtrack. I was like, why would you do that? Like, there's these weird sounds coming out left, right, and center, like beep, beep, beep. And particularly games coders love it. And they get to say, hey, I'm listening to that. I'm just like, isn't that off-putting, that like tinnitus sound that's coming out of the right eardrum? Sure. But in general, I love having stuff for longevity, whereas there are other composers, and it's not right or wrong, you know, we will talk, but there are others that are just like, you serve the film first and foremost. Emotional underneath it or whatever. Whereas for me, I get bored of just having a loop going underneath. It's just like, but it's really boring. It had something else, you know?
Right, right. That's, yeah. You know, I think about composers like Hans Zimmer now, and he has created this whole other side venture of live concerts. And you think to yourself, okay, so surely when you're approaching a film, you think about the movie first. But surely in the back of his head, he must be thinking, what is a banger that I can string together for a concert in the next 2 or 3 years?
So I, beforehand started, I don't know him, absolute genius. But when I saw, I was up for some award years ago in Ghent, and must have been about 10 years ago, I think it was for Limitless. And he was there, and he was doing his live thing before his live thing became a live thing. Blown away by it, like the percussion, the live instruments, the orchestra. And it was just like a 10-minute suite or whatever. And it wasn't, it might have been Inception, some other stuff. But anyway, but it was like that adrenaline-fueled thing. But seeing it now in front of whatever it is, 10, 15,000 people that goes to the gigs, and you're like, this is awesome. It's like games concerts, you know. People just love music. And the fact that it ties into a game or a film or whatever else, music is music is music.
Right.
You just got to hook people into it.
Right, right, yeah. What were your favourite, you mentioned you had favourite movie scores or composers growing up?
First of all, I'm not grown up, how dare you. It's very boring. The Mission, Ennio Morricone is the thing. It's just Gabriel's oboe. It's just fucking beautiful. And again, Morricone's genius, because we go off and do completely different vibes. You know, here's a guy that will take an orchestra into the desert because they're not getting the fight sequence. They will go and write the fight sequence, you know, in the early days, but take an orchestra in and they would literally play live. That was one of the very early versions of the click track. It's like, well, how am I going to do this after? Oh, I know, I have a metronome going tick, 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 da 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 da.
Wow. He's
yes, in a mission. And when I went to the academy, I remember there was an oboist there. And he said, oh, yeah, I played Gabriel's oboe. And I was like, oh, as in the piece. I was like, no way, we're not worthy. Because again, you know, you're 18 and you're like, fucking hell. That's but it turns out since that pretty much every oboe player that you meet claims that they played I don't know if he's right or not.
What's the truth there? Yeah.
But no, so I adore that kind of stuff. Stuff like, what the hell was it called? Dances with Wolves, very cheesy kind of thing, but big kind of 3-hour things.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely gorgeous. And then, you know, you move on because you kind of look at composers that have set the boundaries for the next 10 years. When I first came over to LA, The Social Network was all around. So you got Trenton Atticus. And like now everyone uses it for temp music. I was like, guys, that was 10 years ago. You know, right. Let's have something else.
Right. But
that was groundbreaking in its own right. Inception was groundbreaking in its own right. There are a few kind of movies where you just go, this is completely batshit crazy and it's completely different from anything else. But then I remember the David Arnold Shaken Not Stirred remixes of the Bond movies.
Mm-hmm.
Themes, and that was all kind of, he had some drums from Propeller Heads and kind of remixes underneath and stuff. I was like, this is wicked. You can combine orchestra with drums. I love this shit.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of ones were set me on the path of, I've never really just done orchestral. I've always sort of been a synth and orchestra kind of background. I love it when you fuse the two together.
Interesting. I'm so glad you said The Mission. I already liked you, but now I like you even more. Because
how old were you when you watched it for the first time?
I only watched it for the first time 5 years ago. However, I knew the music. So
you knew it out with the film?
I knew it, yeah, completely out of context from the movie itself. Growing up, my stepfather was really into film music, which is probably why I am today. So I knew that score and a lot of Morricone's scores from when I was maybe 7, 8 years old. And press me today, I will tell you it's my favorite Morricone score. It interchanges between that and Once Upon a Time in America.
Okay, Hateful Eight.
Amazing, amazing. But I would not put it up there with my favorite, you know. I was very fortunate to see Morricone live at the O2 in 2016. And then I never got the chance again, you know. So incredible. I'll always hold that experience dear to my heart. At the O2.
Right.
And you best believe I was a sobbing wreck during The Mission segments with the full choir and, you know.
Yeah, that whole string line that goes da 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 da. And it's so simple. Sorry, my voice is awful, sorry. But, like, it's so simple. But the fact that, so I do some collaborations with Philip Glass. And I was speaking to Philip about it because I was like, the use of the simple motif over the top, and it's how you then do chordal structures underneath. And Philip's wonderful at doing his chords. And he was always like, but Paul, you write such beautiful melodies. I was like, I know, I'm great. you write such great melodies. And for me, it's always been about the tune, but that was always my thing. And going back to when I was at the Academy, Sir Jimmy McMillan was like, I mean, it's all fine, but it's a bit melodic. Why don't you try this? And I was very respectful. But it was like, he did a percussion concerto with Evelyn Glennie and it's absolutely brilliant. And it had melodies. And I was like, that's got a melody. He's like, well, that's not really a melody. So one person's version of a melody might be a short motif, like going back to The Mission. Da 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 dum. It's really just an arpeggio in the same way that Beethoven, da 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 da, the Moonlight Sonata. But somehow Morricone turned that into an entire theme. And I don't know how, but it gets you right there in the soul.
Yeah, right in the soul. Yeah, absolutely.
But damn you for watching it live. I'm jealous.
I know, honestly. I'm very, very lucky. Well, I'm so glad you mentioned Philip Glass because I wanted to move on to him. Because that's one thing I always find fascinating is when composers develop this ongoing collaboration with each other. We recently had composer Volker Bertelmann on the podcast as a guest.
Yeah.
He frequently works with the composer, what's his name, Dustin O'Halloran. So frequently, yeah. And I think they even won the Golden Globe for Lion together, that movie Lion. It was a wonderful score. But so you yourself, yeah, you've worked multiple times with composer Philip Glass. How did that start?
Blackmail. Like, Philip, I have these pictures. What was it? It was Tales from the Loop. It was a wonderful... Well, bizarrely enough, Netflix have just done a thing. Was it The Electric State? So,
yes. The Russo brothers?
Yeah. Doesn't seem to be doing that well.
Mm.
But based on Simon Stalenhag's books. So Tales from the Loop was... So Simon Stalenhag is this incredible artist. He had done a collection of books. One was called Electric State, one was called Tales from the Flood, and one was called Tales from the Loop.
Ah.
So Nathaniel is a very weird way. I'm sort of trying to answer the question as quickly as possible, because Nathaniel, who's the showrunner, had been inspired by the art of Simon Stahlenhag and said, he went to Fox and said, I want to write whatever it was, 8 episodes based on these pictures. So each picture inspired him to write an episode, but with a through line. Mm. And it was utterly beautiful. So it's like art inspiring art, you know, it's like really cool. And so he had got in touch, I think, with my agent, and then Mark Romanek, wonderful director that had done 1 hour photo and tons of pop videos and stuff. He wanted Philip, and they were just like, well, why don't we try the two of them? They've never actually worked together before, but they both worked a lot with Errol Morris, this filmmaker.
Yes.
And we know all of Philip had done like the first, I think, 3 films of Errol's. I've now done 8 with him. Chaos last week was, I think, the 8th. But I think then I'd done about 3. So they were just like, let's try, you know, it might work, it might not. But that's the wonderful thing about collaborations and film music. And I'd never collaborated with anyone before. So I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing, but sure. And Philip was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I was like, I think you do. He's like, no. So I went over to New York and just got chatting with him. And jokes aside, when he said, oh, you write these wonderful themes, I should have recorded him saying that. And he'd done his research on me on, I think, YouTube, which still blows my mind. Yeah, it's like there's Philip sitting at his computer listening to kind of some of my music. So he's like, well, this is wonderful and this is wonderful, but why did you do this with your music? And I was like, well, what do you mean, why did I do this? It's like, well, your melody goes whatever. He said, but your chords were very basic. Why didn't you? And we went up to his piano and he's like, why didn't you do this, this, this? And I was like, I never would have thought of it in a million, like not in a self-deprecating way, not in a I'm crap way, just in a, you're Philip. And that's what makes music so wonderful. Every composer has their own style and the way that their brain goes.
Mm.
And Philip obviously is a fucking genius. He's just like, oh, you've just Philip Glassified my melody.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically how the collaboration started. I was like, okay, great. And then I went back to LA. He sent me some stuff over. And the first time I did it, I was actually shitting myself because I was like, you know, it's Philip, we're not worthy. And I was like, well, I like it. I don't think it's going to work with the film, you know, that first episode. I was like, I love this, 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 this. But how about if I take those chords and then we put this melody on top? Love it. So then he takes the melody and starts doing that. And that was literally how it was. But imagine you're going, dude, to Philip for the first time going like, I mean, it's great. And we totally don't get my idea, but.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm so glad that you mentioned Tales from the Loop, because the score that you did together for that is beautiful. It's so melodic, and it's haunting in its own way. It very much reminds me of Max Richter's score for the TV show The Leftovers.
I haven't seen it. And then someone says, well, The Leftovers reminds me of Philip's one to, what the hell, Truman Show. So, and again, yes. It's not for someone ripping someone off or ripping someone off. It's just like a whole vibe going on kind of thing.
It's the vibe, yeah. It's just these wonderful piano arrangements. And I think it's incredible. And so you've speaking of collaborations, you've mentioned Errol Morris and you have this ongoing collaboration with him. Errol Morris is a celebrated Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker. That's 8 projects together. Surely that's been a handshake agreement from at some point.
Again, like the irony of it. I mean, I feel so, it sounds complete bonkers. I feel so privileged. I can't explain it. Like he won an Oscar for The Thin Blue Line, right? Mm. You got someone off the, death row, basically, who was waiting to be executed, and basically proved that this guy was innocent. And Errol used to be a private detective. He's the most hilarious person out, but his brain is just fucking brilliant. I had no idea. So he would always tell me that. It's like, I was a private detective, couldn't make any money in filmmaking or whatever. And then I kind of decided to put the two together, did this film and got an Oscar for it. It's like, oh, maybe there's hope for me. but again, it's like Philip was a taxi driver until he had his New York cab license until he was mid-40s.
Wow.
And he said, oh, I knew I'd not made it, but I thought I could make a living in this when I got paid to do an opera. And it was like, oh my God, you were a cab driver until you're mid-40s. This is absolutely... So
it's inspiring. Jokes aside,
like, it shows you, like, it doesn't matter when you start on things. It's just so long as you have a passion for it, it's what you want to do. But yeah, so Errol, you know, had done that. And then I was brought on, God, what was it? It was a thing called Wormwood. It was a series on LSD mind control, which took MK Ultra. And while that was being made, he said, oh, I've got this film on the B side. And Stephen, who's Errol's editor, who is, I mean, he's more than an editor. He's just everything. Yeah, you know, it's such a close team. And I think it's really hard to describe to people when you're on some features, and it's like massive music teams, massive edit teams, massive everything. There's just so many people because you're trying to get it over the line.
Mm.
Whereas with Errol, it's such a core. There's Igor, who's the cinematographer, who's brilliant. You've got Stephen, who's the editor. Molly, who's the researcher, but not just a researcher. You've Stephen, who's an editor, but not just an editor.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremy, that does all the graphics. He'd done Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, but also does Errol stuff. And last week, we were at the Chaos premiere. It was the first time I think we'd all been in the room, except for Stephen, that couldn't be there. It was the first time we've ever all been in the same room at the same time. This is amazing. Yeah, we've done all these films together, but never actually sort of been together. So it was really
that's
cool
crazy.
And weird, you know, when you see everyone on Zoom the whole time. And it's like, I feel like I know you and your children, but yet I've never met you.
right. With approaching projects like Errol's work, is there ever a point where you think this is the subject matter? How the hell am I supposed to create music that can in any way, you know, shapen or heighten or just bring to the fore any of what? Is there anything in particular in any of his work where you went, oh, I don't know how I'm going to do this?
it's a genuinely a really good question, because one of the things that I hate is doing the same thing over again. I've got a very short attention span, as you can see. and I like challenging myself. I like doing different things. You know, Mod Synths, like, you know, on the guys over there in the studio, is like, you never get the same sound twice because you stick your cables in and then you do your various tweaks and then you record it as audio. Whereas when you're doing stuff in the box, what I call it, you know, in the computer,
mm-hmm.
recall the exact sound that you've got. But on outboard gear, synthesizers, it's never the same sound twice. So going to Errol, it's like, well, look, you're trying to do the different soundtrack each time because I don't want him to feel you're phoning it in and just doing the same old, same old. But that said, Errol has a very definite style. He always uses orchestra, but it doesn't just be classical orchestra, but the pace of the music, I mean, it's wall to wall. It drives his movies. Music in the first three, or how many it was, of Errol's, has set the tone of it. And it became known, Errol became known for his relationship with Philip because it was very much about the pacing.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came on, I was like, okay, I'll try this. And on the second film, Errol was like, look, fucking love your stuff. Don't worry about trying to be Philip or trying to be someone else. He said, I came to you not because of that. I came to you because I love your music.
Right.
So do your thing. You know, I love the last thing. And so do it. It's like, God, this is great. And creatively, suddenly I was on just using electric cello. And I'm thinking to myself, because this was however long ago, will Errol Morris, the Oscar winner, like electric cello?
Mm-hmm.
So you then get in a mindset which is a completely different way. Instead of trying to second guess what people want, when he said that, it gave me the confidence just to be myself.
Right.
And suddenly it's just like so much more fun. Instead of trying to second guess, you're like, let's take the electric cello. We're going to take a quartet. We're going to reverse the quartet. I'm going to have piano. I'm going to douse it in reverb. I'm going to do this. I'm going to have orchestra. And suddenly every film is making sense to me because I'm getting to know Errol, but also getting to know Stephen and getting to know their filmmaking style.
Mm-hmm.
But I struggled last year for the first time on Errol film, this being brutally honest. It's a film he did called Separated, and it's nothing to do with the film. The film is wonderful, but it's about child border policies and children being ripped away from their families. And it happens in the UK with the migrant boats coming in, and it happens over here at the Mexican border, where, and so Trump had initiated a thing going like, right, we are going to remove children, like 6 months old, a year, year and a half from their families. We're going to rip them apart because this is going to put people off coming in. And whatever your politics are, I find that abhorrent.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it was never official policy
but it was happening, is just what the fuck. So it's not even law, but this shit goes on. And again, you know, I'm not saying there's an easy answer, anything like that. That's not the point of Errol's films. Errol's films are about things to people's attention. He did one on Steve Bannon and how Trump got into power. So it became quite political. But that film was so harrowing for me that if you put depressing music on a depressing subject matter, it's like over-egging the pudding and no one's going to watch it because it's just miserable. And it doesn't mean that it's not good, but it's a limit to the amount of misery that you're going to put. I remember watching Requiem for a Dream and like that as a film, and like I felt fucking miserable by the end of it and moved. Yeah. Kind of what art is, but you know, it should make you feel something. So Separated, and I said to Stephen, it's like I'm still pleased with what I did, but I think it was because tonally it was such a hard film because it's such hard subject matter. So sometimes you can't make it happy because it's not a happy subject matter, and it's stock, not a film, not like a written film, scripted film. So it's not like you're trying to sort of make people feel something emotionally. Not, you can only go with what's in front of you. So yeah, by the end of it, I was absolutely worn out emotionally as much as anything else.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I can only imagine. Heavy subject matter. Yeah. And after you have these collaborations, like with Philip Glass, and you work with another composer and they bring things to the table, when you next go on to your next film and you're working solo, do you ever think to yourself, damn it, I'd love to know what Philip thought.
No, he just tell me I'm great. Okay, you liar. I mean, I haven't done tons of collaborations. So Philip, as I say, I've done three collaborations with. Mm-hmm. And at the same time as doing Tales from the Loop, I was doing Cyberpunk with Marcin and Piotr in Warsaw. So they're kind of in-house composers. That sounds deprecating because they're fucking brilliant. But they work for CD Projekt Red, who made Cyberpunk. So they brought me in and kind of said, hey, come and join the collaboration. And it was cool. You know, it was very different, obviously, to Philip's one because it's hardcore electronica, which is kind of like what my Dread soundtrack was. It was years ago. But I think that whole thing of kind of feeding off each other, you know, you're trying to sort of not be inspired by the other people, but kind of like take their vibes and then, but you know, you're doing your own thing as well and trying to meld it in. So those are the only two actual people that I've collaborated with.
Right.
But then when you go back to your own stuff, I say your own stuff, but you know, just working solo.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about, for me, it's not about wanting to know what they would think of it. I think sometimes it's nice to actually have a sounding board to play people's stuff. Right. Say, what do you think of this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not in a case of, oh, you're great or oh, you're shit, or whatever, but just like, does this sound like good? I think it sounds really weird. You know, is that good or bad? So I sometimes send that off to friends that are composers or directors or whatever, not for creative input, but a script writer would send their script to someone for some input, just saying, hey,
absolutely.
Yeah. It's like, does this, do you understand what's going on? Yeah, I think that's all I need is, do you understand, how does this track make you feel?
Yes, okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. And you've, you know, you are such a versatile composer, truly, in that you seem to have no objections composing for anything. You score movies, video games, documentaries, TV shows, and you jump seamlessly between these projects. You scored Limitless, which was a feature film, and that became a TV series, for which you continue to score, and that score was Emmy nominated. And in the case of Last Breath, that was a documentary that you scored that then became a narrative feature. And how do you approach that? Is that something that's of a piece, or do you decide to take a different approach to each one?
So let's start with Limitless.
Mm-hmm.
Limitless was my first, inverted commas, big feature film. It went to number one, and that was the thing that was kind of my big break. You know, I've been obviously writing bloody ages before, but suddenly Limitless has got Robert De Niro, Bradley Cooper, went to number one. Suddenly everyone's just like, oh, he's good. It's like, right. It doesn't make you any better composer than you were 6 months ago, but suddenly it's like, right. It helps raise awareness, I guess, you know. Then I got Dread and I did Walking with Dinosaurs and all that kind of stuff, but that was the first break. And then they turned it into a TV series about 4 years later, I want to say, while it was still in the kind of psyche of people. But a lot of the time when you do TV shows, like that was 22 episodes and they want it to be different from the film. But of course, they don't want it to be different from the film because otherwise they wouldn't have taken the branding in the first place. But doing a 22-part series is different from that. So thematically, it was all different. But I definitely, tonally, it was that hardcore electronica pulsing beats and drums. Mm. Very frenetic because it was about a guy on drugs. And when he took the drugs, he suddenly got clarity. I was blind, now I can see, you know, kind of thing. So that made sense to me. On to Last Breath, the film that came out 2 weeks ago. Well, it comes out in the UK, I think, next week. But that was a documentary about 5 years ago, I want to say, maybe six, I don't know, however long ago it was. And the documentary was incredibly music-driven, but from an emotional point of view. It's about a diver who, three deep-sea divers, they go down a month at a time, high-pressurized container, and then one of them leaves that high-pressurized container, ends up on the seabed to go and fix fiber optic cables or oil rigs or whatever. So it's like a mile below sea level. I mean, they're insane.
This is actually a job.
Right, it's actually a job, and this is actually a true story. So in this guy's oxygen tank, is the cable to it, the umbilical cord, gets stuck, and he ends up as the anchor for the boat that's at the very, very top in a massive storm, and it's dragging him off. His cable's stuck around this oil platform down on the seabed at the bottom of the North Sea, and the only solution is that the umbilical cord gets snapped. Mm. He's there, pitch black at the bottom of the sea, can't find anything. I mean, imagine how cold and how dark and everything else. And you're supposed to be able to last without oxygen for, I think it's like 8 minutes or something. And when his body was recovered, he'd been down there for 45 minutes. No oxygen. And I won't give the game away or any else, but the point is, it was incredibly emotional, but it was a documentary. It was a very unique documentary. But it was musically very emotional. The film, when we sat down and spoke about the film, and again, yeah, a lot of the time they'll go, we want something completely different with a different composer that has no connection with the IP previously. Yeah. Other times they're going, no, this IP is working really well, and so on. And Alex Parkinson, the wonderful director, foolish man, brought me along with him for the feature as well. But when we started talking about the film, it became quite apparent that it's a Hollywoodized version of it. So it's a lot more dramatic. So there's a lot more kind of action. So you start off every soundtrack going, how do I envisage this? What's my intellectual thinking for this? And whereas with the doc, it had been, okay, well, this is the emotional reaction. I want to get to know these three divers. With the film, sure, you want to get to know the three divers, but it's about the sheer scale of the North Sea, the massive waves. And then you're suddenly underneath. The sound changes completely. You know, now you're just like muffled and under there. What sounds cut through? Mm. But it was very much about the drums. I sampled up, I hit the side of a boat, made a sample out of it, and suddenly that becomes the percussion. It's like, and it's just me whacking this boat with a metal pole. And so all those elements then combine to create this thing, which is very different from the doc. But then after you found the action in it, you realize, sure, it still needs the soul, though. It still needs the soul of these divers and all. Fortunately, people have reacted really well to the music, but like writing paragraphs and paragraphs about it going, wow, this music leads the way, because it really does. All you've got under that water is boom, 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 you know, the heartbeat, whatever, which becomes this pulsing bass and this weird electric cello. But then as they're being saved or not saved, you've got the rousing music. But the point of all this is it's very different from the doc. So you're not trying to imitate it like in Limitless, where it was sonically one thing. This is very different.
Right, okay. And exactly to what you said earlier, I guess it wouldn't interest you to just repeat yourself anyway.
No, like genuinely, I've said no to so many things because it just, you know, they say, oh, I love that soundtrack. I was like, well, that's nice, but I've done it.
Mm.
Yeah, and sure, you'll kind of write a few things that, obviously, it's your style. It's not like you can change your style like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay, that's fine. You know, I'm writing away and I have a very string-led style or a piano-led style. I'm not necessarily Mr. Rock guitar style, but I will use guitar, you know, in my stuff. But everyone inherently has a style if you're not trying to imitate other people, whether it's a band or a composer or whatever else. But I think that for me, it just keeps it fresh. And like 2 years ago, the irony of all of this, I did an album. I just needed 3 weeks off. It's been so busy over the last 10 years. I was just like, I'm just going to write my own album. I need it for my soul. It's not for anything. It's not for anyone. It was an album of etudes. and it was for piano, and I met this cellist. I'd done a concerto over in France, and this drummer said, hey, you should meet this cellist. She studied at the Juilliard. She's phenomenal. So I was like, all right, you know, well, and she came up to the studio, and super cool woman. And Suvi, her name is. And so I was like, well, look, I'm literally just writing these etudes at the moment for piano. Do you want to, will I make them for piano and cello and we can do them together? She's like, yeah, sure. So did them. She did some demos. They sat there because then it became busy again. And, you know, I was, so 2 years on, and I'm kind of like, okay, look, we'll try and get a day. I mean, it's so hard just to find a day. It's like, right, we'll get, we went to Sunset Sound where the Beach Boys recorded, got her in, recorded the cello. And then she was like, oh, look, this dancer who I know wants to, has heard them, it's just the demos, wants to dance to them. So I was like, okay, great. You know, I haven't got time to come out and perform them, but here, so I recorded the piano for her. She played the cello over the top, and she's brilliant. And she sent me visuals of it. And it was the principal dancers of the San Francisco Ballet. And it was just stunning. And what made me, without sounding cheesy, like what got me was when we were talking about the mission earlier on, there's something that gets you in your, my soul. I sold it. It's in there somewhere.
It's in there.
Your soul. Seeing dancers react to a piece of music that I just wrote for me was wonderful. But then this weird thing happened, and suddenly Keaton Lear, this incredible dancer of the Toronto Ballet, had heard them. It's like, I would love to choreograph for this. Suddenly he's performing it in front of 5,000 people in front of Al Gore and the Artist Climate Collective over in the States the end of last year. And I'm like, this is just like something I did for me. It's like little old, I don't mean that again, I don't mean it self-deprecating, little old me, but like, it's not for anything. It was just for my soul. And they suddenly took on a life of their own. So we did a launch gig at the end of last October, recorded them properly, mixed them. 200 people came to East-West Studios, which is in Los Angeles, super kind of historic building. Sinatra would have been there, the Rat Pack.
Wow.
So much history. Lots of Motown guys. And anyway, really super vibe, really cool. Move on to the start of this year. I've done these electronica remixes, which again have been sitting there. I was just finding the time to finish them. I made myself finish them. And this was now, what, about 5 weeks ago, I want to say. I was just going up to Skywalker to record this. Sorry, you're in the UK. Skywalker, which is up north.
The about, Ranch, is it?
Yeah, the Skywalker Ranch. Mm-hmm. Recording studio and all that stuff. George Lucas's place. And so I finished them. I've got 5 remixes done. They'll be going up, you know, on Spotify probably in a month or something. And I got a call from a producer saying, blah, 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 would love you to chat to this director, Chesway's director, got on really well. But it's a film about ballerinas. And I, the first person I've told this story to, because that's literally what I'm about to start scoring. And it's a film about ballerinas, but it's not a kind of classical ballerina thing. And she said, oh, by the way, you know, I've heard that you wrote some stuff for dance. I would love to see it. So I was like, here you go, but it's not relevant for your film at all because it's super classical. That's not how I see your film. Mm-hmm. But also, here are these remixes, which you've done for these people, but they're not out yet, so please don't share, etc. Mm-hmm. And I've got this email back, and I'm just going, this is exactly how I see my film. And I was just like, I was sat there going, that is utterly bizarre that something you do for yourself as opposed to for someone else inspires all these dancers, for whatever reason, I don't know why, to do stuff. And then you end up scoring a film which is dance-related. It was just weird and made me feel like, just do shit for yourself. You know, build it and it'll come kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. It takes on a life of its own, yeah.
Well, I've totally gone off on one, but I'm super happy about this.
That's so exciting. Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. Maybe at this point you can't do anything for yourself anymore.
It really is finding that time. But like, I just loved it because it was something for me that inspired. It's all about inspiring people. That should be what... And music is art. Music of all forms, whether it's, you know, Taylor or Olivia or the Beatles or whatever, it's still art.
Mm.
About creating reaction to people. You go to a gallery and you sit in front. I remember going to MoMA with my wife years ago in New York, and we were sat in front of the water lilies, and she burst out crying. My wife's an artist, and she burst out crying, and I couldn't see it.
Mm.
She's like, I studied these when I was at school, Glasgow School of Art, and you can see him gradually getting more and more blind, and it's blurred over there, but the clarity there. And she was describing it, and it was beautiful, but I didn't get the same emotional reaction that she did. But that is what art is about.
That's what it is.
People to feel something.
Yes, so subjective. It will hit every individual person a different way.
Yeah,
yes.
For good or bad. You
for
might
good
go,
or bad.
It doesn't mean that it's a shit film or a shit piece of art. It just means it's not for you.
Yes.
I mean, there is some shit, but...
Yes, we won't talk about those. Well, Paul, I want to say it's been such a pleasure talking to you. It really has. I want to say a huge thank you for taking the time today. It's much appreciated. And I wish you all the best for your future endeavors. And I look forward to hearing everything you do next.
Thank you very much. Go see Last Breath next week when it's out, all right?
Absolutely, we'll do.
Chaos is on, that's on Manson. That's on Netflix at the moment.
On Netflix. So everyone listening, please do that. Last Breath should be coming out in the next week in the UK. It is a theatrical release. It will be in cinemas. And Chaos is the new Errol Morris documentary. It's called Chaos, the Manson Murders. And you can hear Paul Leonard's music on that. Check it out and then rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you back here for the next episode on the Phoenix Cinema Podcast. Bye for now.